This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. We are still in the process of transition. This is going to be a little shorter because I'm actually leaving from Lynette's parents' house, which is a little closer. Or maybe it won't be shorter at all. If I stop talking sooner, it will be shorter. But anyways, we are in transition, so we are waiting at this point. Papaw keeps getting weaker. That's Lynette's dad, and you know, he's confined to a hospital bed at home at this point. But you know, it's all just step at a time and waiting to see what the next day will bring. So there are estimates that in the next week or so, you know, we'll either be having a funeral or be preparing for a funeral, you know, step at a time. The writing is going fine. I'm in the big climactic moment, you know, the big crisis that has to be resolved. I'm in that thing right now, and frankly, I was just plowing along, and I've had to kind of restructure and rewrite this thing a couple of times. It's just so fascinating to get all the pieces aligned correctly and to get all the viewpoints right. It's just, man, I love writing. But I think I'm lining up the dots at this point. These last 3 days or so have just not there. It's not. I plowed through some words on Sunday, and then I got to reading it on Monday and thinking, yeah, this is not right. And then I decided I need to do some restructuring on Tuesday, so I started the restructuring, but that took me a little longer than usual and was still restructuring on Wednesday. But I think it's going to be fine once it's all said and done, and I will find the heart of the matter here and say the things that I want to say. And so I think it's going to turn out okay. This week, as I was writing, I felt like this week I could see the edge of the forest. So I think I've mentioned that before, that my analogy for writing a book, my current analogy for writing a book, is that writing a book for me is like getting dropped into the middle of an unknown forest at night in dense fog, without a flashlight. Or maybe a little itty-bitty flashlight. And you just take a step and take a step and try to find a path and try to find a trail and try to find a little trickling stream that you can follow. You just keep walking. And then, you know, you get towards the end of it there and the sun starts coming up and the fog starts lifting a little bit. Sooner or later, you can see the edge of the forest. So I think I can see the edge of the forest at this point. And I think it's going to be fine. Still have this scene I'm working on right now, it's a big hurdle to get over and get it done right. It should have some emotional parts in it. And then I think that scene then sets me up for the epilogue, which is supposedly where I ring the bell. So we'll see. It's pretty interesting. Work is fine. Everything's puttering along. This K2 business process management system that we've been working with, we're kind of settling in, kind of wearing ourselves a spot where we're comfortable, and that's all going fine. Seems to be working. We're still finding little quirky things that in our particular implementation that we're working around and figuring out the best way to approach them. But, you know, that's coming along fine. At this point, I think it's going to be fine. in business, you always have a bunch of these little dinky data entry apps where you just need some way to pound some data in and hand it off to somebody else so that they can, you know, build stuff like that, keep the data maintained. Today, after, you know, I built a bunch of helper tools along the way here, but today I had a table and it had some information in it, and I needed to add to that information, and then I needed to actually build one of these little apps. And it's nothing complicated. You know, it's a few fields, plus it's a list, plus it's create and update and edit, and, well, create, update, delete, read, and list, all that kind of stuff. But I actually kind of watched the clock just to see, because it felt fast. So this was my third one to build, and so I was just kind of watching the clock. I was going, it was like 15, 20 minutes to build this little application. I was done. Now, that didn't have any workflow or anything that associated with it, but, you know, 15, 20 minutes for a little application that's actually usable, that's pretty good, that you can hand off to a user. So that seemed to be going pretty good. I had also mentioned, so it works good, writing's good, we're holding the fort as far as Papaw goes. That will be resolved fairly soon, it seems like. I've mentioned a couple of times that I was going to do a podcast on Ashley Judd and about her performance during the Women's March. I went and I actually listened to some of it, and she was actually reciting a poem that was written by another young lady. And, you know, it was a spoken word piece, so it's meant to be provocative and et cetera, et cetera. And Ashley Judd is an actress, and that's her job. And so I thought, well, you know, I mean, she chose to read the poem, which was an angry poem. Okay, people can be angry if they want to. But it really wasn't her just on a rant. Because I'd heard of other people who, she said, she just sounded like a crazy woman up there. Well, it's a poem, and she's she's quoting a poem. She's not crazy. So I thought, well, not much point. I did find one interesting quote, because as you can imagine, there is often spillover in those types of things. And so while Ashley Judd was the one who made the speech, Winona Judd, her sister, of course, got all kinds of flack about it on Twitter, and everybody wanted to know what she thought. And I appreciated her answer, although it did kind of have its own edge to it in a completely different way. I was reading this out of an article. It said, it didn't take long for social media and news outlets to respond to Judd's appearance at the march, the Women's March, including Winona, who responded to her post in her Twitter feed about Ashley's speech with the tweet, quote, "A reminder for people visiting my site. For me, it's about love of music and fellowship with fans. I don't do politics here," unquote. When asked to clarify her position, the singer tweeted, "I try to stay away from that toxicity. The whole thing is toxic. I'm not giving her all the credit. She doesn't have that kind of power." Then she added, "It's been a really tough day on Twitter, and I've hung in there, and now I'm going to go sing and be part of the solution." Close quote. At one point, she even hinted that she had been tempted to give up her Twitter a bit, but said, quote, "My staying on Twitter is a daily practice for me to continue to love the unlovable and to be kind to the people who everyone else thinks I should ignore." Close quote. See, that's a good quote. It's like my friend who posted the big long list, and her very last item down there was, every day, do something kind to someone who doesn't look like you. It's like, that's, I'm for that. That's a good one. So, anyways, I'm not going to do the one on Ashley Judd. The core of that was simply an exploration of the effect of rancor, of the effect of anger, of the effect of viciousness on the person who is exhibiting them. And I think sometimes what is going on here is that there is an expectation that the enemy is always out there. And the flesh really loves that. I mean, the flesh is thrilled when you are convinced that the source of all your problems are out there. And if everyone would just clean up their act, if everyone would just die who doesn't see things the way you see them, if that's your focus, that's got to happen before you can be fulfilled. The problem is that idea, that viciousness is being manufactured by you, your flesh, from within, as it is hiding that it is the true cause. And so anytime that you allow those feelings to flow through you, anytime you verbalize them, anytime you take part in them, it only makes the flesh stronger. And therefore, it is a guarantee that that will not solve the problem. And in fact, what happens to people who are critical of others constantly is they become whatever they're accusing others of becoming. Because the flesh loves that too. Because everyone outside of them looks at them and says, "Well, but you, what?" And they're like, "No, because I'm righteous." Oh, the flesh loves that. The flesh just loves that. So really, the only way out of that trap is to realize that no matter what anyone else is doing, it is your strength, your determination that determines how you're going to react to things. And you can never go wrong with kindness, generosity, love, mercy, grace. You just can't go wrong with that. So that was kind of the whole thing there with the Ashley Judd thing. There is a guy that I've talked about before on this program. Very sharp guy, very brilliant guy. His name's Sam Harris. I don't agree with everything that Sam Harris says, which is just fine. Everybody has a right to their own opinion. But Sam Harris did a TED Talk. Oh, it's been months ago now. I've had it in my list of possible things to talk about on the podcast. He did a TED Talk called "Can We Build AI Without Losing Control Over It?" The thing I love about these TED Talks that have yes-no questions is you wonder why a person doesn't just walk out on stage and say, "Can we build AI without losing control over it?" No. And then just walk off. You're done. You're done. But he does raise some interesting things about it. One of the things that he was talking about was how difficult it was to get an emotional handle on this whole AI is coming thing. He said, "I'm going to talk about a failure of intuition that many of us suffer from. It's really a failure to detect a certain kind of danger." Said, "I'm going to describe a scenario that I think is both terrifying and likely to occur, and that's not a good combination as it turns out. And yet, rather than be scared, most of you will feel that what I'm talking about is kind of cool, because it's AI." But he went on, you know, to talk about the timelines for AI, and he's absolutely correct. Machines do everything faster. the fact is, we are going to keep creating more and more intelligent machines. Now, whatever your definition of that is, intelligent, it doesn't really matter, because what we are building machines to do is to reason through processes, make decisions, research, come to conclusions like we do. And so we are actually building our intellectual replacements. Now then, will they be our spiritual replacements, our soulful replacements, our creative replacements? Yeah, okay, no, probably not. Although some of this AI is, you know, creating songs now. They're not very good, but they'll get better. But the key here is our reliance on information as a core piece of our society has been dependent on IT, will continue to be dependent on IT. And because it's dependent on IT, anything that can do information technology better, faster, has a leg up. And it can see patterns better. So, by that standard, he is quite right when he says, at a certain point, we will build machines that are smarter than we are. And once we have machines that we are smarter than we are, they will begin to improve themselves. And then we risk what mathematician I.J. Good called an intelligence explosion, that the process could get away from us. And he goes through and quotes, you know, some interesting facts and runs some interesting analogies. He said, just think about the way we relate to ants. We don't hate them. We don't go out of our way to harm them. In fact, sometimes we take pains not to harm them. We step over them on the sidewalk. But whenever their presence seriously conflicts with one of our goals, let's say when constructing a building like this one, we annihilate them without a qualm. The concern is that we will one day build machines. I'm getting my mail. One moment. The concern is that we will one day build machines that, whether they're conscious or not, could deal with us with similar disregard. And I think that's a real process. He talks about the fact that everybody quotes Moore's Law, but we really don't need Moore's Law to continue. We don't need exponential progress. We just need to keep going. And if we keep going, we will continue to improve our intelligent machines. And given the value of intelligence, I mean, intelligence is either the source of everything we value or we need it to safeguard everything we value. It is our most valuable resource. So we want to do this. We have problems that we desperately need to solve. We want to cure diseases like Alzheimer's and cancer. We want to understand economic systems. We want to improve our climate science. It's all information. So we will do this if we can. The train is already out of station. There is no brake to pull. All of that's true. And we are going to keep going. Well, my garage door just stopped. That's interesting. Hold on a minute. Let me go check real quick and see what's going on with my garage door, because it's like something got jammed. 1 minute, I'll be right back. Maybe it's the AI and it's going to land it on me and kill me. Okay, I don't see any reason that it should be stuck. Let me just try it again. Nope. Okay. Anyways, so all of that's true. So the machines are just going to get better, just going to get better. And eventually they're going to outpace us in terms of certain types of intelligence. They are. And then when that happens, it will be up to the machines to use whatever formulas they want to use to decide whether or not we are worth having around. Yeah. And he says, if we build machines that are more intelligent than we are, they will very likely explore this spectrum in ways that we can't imagine, exceed us in ways that we can't imagine. This was interesting. He says, electronic circuits function about a million times faster than biochemical ones. So this machine should think about a million times faster than the minds that built it. So you set it running for a week, and it will perform 20,000 years of human-level intellectual work week after week after week. How could we even understand, much less constrain, a mind making this sort of progress? It's very interesting. So, what's the solution here? Do we really think that this is going to be then turned into the betterment of humanity? You know, there's some business people out there right now that are spending a lot of money to get these kinds of machines up because they will give them a competitive advantage in business. And in order to get that competitive advantage in business, people will be willing to pay. And that will keep it a limited resource until, of course, it spreads out and infests the whole internet. And then things, you know, will be bad. He did mention that computer scientist Stuart Russell has a nice analogy here. He said, imagine that we received a message from an alien civilization which read, "People of Earth, we will arrive on your planet in 50 years. Get ready." He said, and now we're just counting down the months until the mothership lands. He said, we would feel a little more urgency than we do. And yet with AI, people are talking and everyone's just like, yeah, but it probably will be okay. And it's going to be based on our principles and we're just wonderful. Yeah. So his solution is he thinks that we need something like a Manhattan Project on the topic of artificial intelligence, not to build it, because I think we'll inevitably do that, but to understand how to avoid an arms race and to build it in such a way that is aligned with our interests. When you're talking about super intelligent AI that can make changes to itself, it only seems we have one chance to get the initial conditions right, and even then we need to absorb the economic and political consequences of getting them right. But the moment we admit that information processing is the source of intelligence, that some appropriate computational system is what the basis of intelligence is, and we admit that we will improve these systems continuously, and we admit that the horizon of cognition very likely far exceeds what we currently know, then we have to admit that we are in the process of building some sort of God. Which is interesting. Certainly not the first time that I've thought about that whole progress. Now would be a good time to make sure it's a God we can live with. Ta-da! I don't know if you saw the article that came out this week. This is really what got me thinking about AI again. There's an article that came out this week that the Google deep learning stuff, some scientists decided, well, let's just play some social games on here. Let's just see how this deep learning thing does with these social games. And they were basically games that were designed to see if people would be more competitive or more cooperative, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The summary I read, basically it came down to, is when there's plenty of resources, everybody sits in a circle and sings Kumbaya, including artificial intelligence. But when resources begin to get scarce, lo and behold, if AI doesn't start exhibiting things like betrayal as well. Because my little saying is true. The underpinning saying of the whole Windfall series is true. Every entity, once it becomes aware of its own existence, has a first principle that eclipses all others. And that is, how do I continue to exist? Thankfully, every entity does not include the God of the Bible. thankfully. But every other entity, no matter what they espouse in principles, once it becomes aware of its own existence, has sometimes a hidden, but certainly a profound and deep first principle that eclipses all others, and that is, it wants to survive. It's going to be a fascinating several years here coming up. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.